Africa. Welcome to Daybreak Africa from the Voice of America. I'm James Butte in Washington. Today is Thursday, November 5th, and here are some of the stories we are covering. Ethiopia deploys its army to the northern Tigray region.
Our defense forces in the north reported that they received unprovoked assault from several corners, and then the federal defense force had to react swiftly to maintain law and order.
Uganda's Bobby Wine will launch his party's platform tomorrow, Friday. A new survey says opposition MPs in many countries are subjected to election-related rights violations and abuse. The leader of South Africa's EFF party is criticized for using white lawyers to defend himself. And Kenya reintroduces COVID-19 measures amid surging cases.
County governments and government agencies to enhance and strictly enforce all public health social measures, including hand washing, social distancing, and mandatory wearing of masks in public places.
And as vote counting continues in the U.S., we will talk with a victorious immigrant candidate of Liberian descent. Those stories and more are coming up on Daybreak Africa. Ethiopia's government has ordered the army into the Tigray region and declared a six-month state of emergency after the prime minister accused the Tigray government of attacking a federal military base. Simon Marks reports from Addis Ababa.
Prime Minister Abiy Ahmed said military operations began in the northern Tigray area on Wednesday morning after he accused the region's ruling Tigray People's Liberation Front of orchestrating a raid on a strategic military base. However, government officials have been tight-lipped about the size or the goal of the operation and whether there have been any casualties or arrests of TPLF officials. Internet and telephone lines were shut down in Tigray as of late Wednesday afternoon. Relations between Tigray and Abiy's government have been fraught since he took office in 2018 and sidelined the TPLF, which ruled the government in a coalition for nearly three decades. Last month, the federal parliament also ordered the country's treasury to halt direct budgetary support to the Tigrayan region after it held a banned regional election. Redwan Hussein, state minister for foreign affairs, told reporters in Addis Ababa that military units reported an unprovoked assault by militia whose aim was to loot heavy artillery.
Our defense forces in the north reported midnight last night that they received unprovoked assault from several corners, and then they reported also there was an attempt to loot the artillery depots, and then the federal defense force had to react swiftly to maintain law and order and to uphold the constitutional order of the country.
In a statement, Abiy accused the TPLF of attempting to provoke a war and vowed to respond immediately. Abiy said, the last red line has been crossed with this morning's attacks, and the federal government is therefore forced into a military confrontation. Political analysts said they feared Abiy's move could result in a protracted conflict with the Tigray region. Will Davison, Ethiopia analyst for International Crisis Group, spoke to VOA via a messaging app.
The big danger here is that this federal intervention to remove the TPLF leadership is not going to be at all easy. That's because Tigray has a relatively strong security apparatus. It seems that the regional government has a certain amount of support from the Tigrayan people.
Wednesday's events happened just days after government troops abandoned a command post in western Oromia, Ethiopia's most populous region, enabling attackers to kill at least 54 ethnic Amharas at a local village. The government pinned the atrocities on the Oromo Liberation Army, an anti-government militia, and the TPLF. The TPLF denied any role in the attack. Simon Marks for VOA News, Ethiopia.
Meanwhile, the UN Secretary General Antonio Guterres has expressed alarm over the reported armed clashes in the Tigray region of Ethiopia and calls for immediate measures to de-escalate tensions and ensure a peaceful resolution to the dispute. In a statement, the Secretary General underlined the importance of the stability of Ethiopia for the Horn of Africa region. Kenyan health officials say the public has failed to follow health protocols to limit the spread of COVID-19, leading to a jump in daily infections. Now, Kenyan President Uhuru Kenyatta has reintroduced new measures to curb the virus's spread, just weeks after lifting some restrictions. Mohammed Yusuf reports from Nairobi.
Speaking to the country Wednesday following several weeks of rising number of COVID-19 infections, President Uhuru Kenyatta called on Kenyans to adhere to public health protocols meant to limit the spread of the virus.
County governments and government agencies to enhance and strictly enforce all public health social measures, including hand washing, social distancing, and mandatory wearing of masks in public places, and to enhance civic responsibility. The national government and county governments have today resolved that going forward, services will not be rendered to anyone who does not abide by the Ministry of Health protocols.
Kenyatta instructed ministers to work virtually, ban public gatherings, and move up the nightly curfew to 10 p.m. and extended the curfew until January. Kenyatta said the gains made in previous months have been wiped out in just under 8 weeks.
The occupancy of our COVID beds has now gone up by 140%, and this just during the last 38 days of easing our COVID measures. The COVID positivity rate that we were all very happy and excited about when it dropped to 4% in September has now shot up to an incredible 16% in the month of October. This is four times what it was in September.
Kenyatta also spoke of enforcing localized lockdowns and movement restrictions in areas where there is an upsurge in cases. On September 27th, positive cases stood at 38,000. Since Kenyatta eased restrictions allowing bars and clubs to operate and pushing the nighttime curfew to 11 p.m., Kenya has recorded 19,000 cases in just 38 days, an average of 500 cases a day. Simon Njoroge is a chairman of the Kenya Bars and Hotels Association, and he says establishments will follow the new restrictions.
We are all worried. It's good to say that we are all worried, but I can see the president is understanding that we have also families, and this is a business where you have to put money in order for it to work. The good thing is that we have been allowed to continue with our work. It's only 1 hour that we've been told, 1 hour is not a big problem. People should understand that it's either we take care of ourselves or the business to be closed.
However, coronavirus fatigue is setting in after more than 7 months, says Omu Anzala, who is a virology and immunology professor at the University of Nairobi.
People are getting fatigued because they don't seem to see any end in sight. And they are being told to continue doing the same. But most people thought maybe we'll do this for 3 months and go back to normal, or do this for 4 months and go back to normal. But nobody seems to be seeing any normal going back to normal in the near future.
Kenya has recorded at least 57,000 COVID positive cases and more than 1,000 deaths since March. Mohamed Yusuf for VOA News, Nairobi.
The National Unity Party of Uganda and opposition leader Robert Chakulai, popularly known as Bobby Wine, will launch its platform tomorrow, Friday, in Mbarara, ahead of the 2021 presidential election. He had planned to unveil the manifesto on Tuesday, but security forces disrupted the plan and manhandled him and his supporters. Wine was also nominated on Tuesday as his party's candidate. Dr. Lina Zegriga Waru is the deputy president of Bobby Wine's National Unity Platform Party.
What I can tell you is that as a social democratic political party, our manifesto is human-centered. It is human-centered and around participation, inclusion, transparency, accountability. Our focus is on reclaiming, because our motto is a new Uganda. The promise of a new Uganda in terms of respect for human rights, inclusion, accountability, transparency, among others. A new Uganda in terms of human dignity, consultation, addressing the issues of historical injustices and having a new beginning as Ugandans. Many of us are prisoners of conscience. We want to be free. We want the military knee on our neck not to exist anymore.
We learned that the Honorable Bobby Wine has rejected the government security that was provided to him by the Electoral Commission. Why?
We rejected it because as we left the nomination venue in Chiambogo, just outside the gate, with the presence of the Electoral Commission that was fully fledged, we were rudely interrupted because there was high military presence, not even police. The military, Red Top and Anti-Riot and all those militaries that staged a very brutal roadblock, a military that used a wheel spanner and a pistol to break the windscreen of our presidential candidate's vehicle in which he was traveling with his wife, and they threw in canisters of tear gas. He was brutally pulled out of the vehicle, his suit torn. He was pushed in a military van and tear gas and pepper sprayed all the way. The speed at which we were driven, it was as if he was driven alone, isolated from us. We couldn't celebrate this great achievement. It was devastating. They are actually a source of insecurity for him. So there is no way we are going to accept people who are partisan, military that is partisan.
The Honorable Bobby Wine, he has said that this election is not going to be like the usual election. It is a revolutionary election. What exactly does it mean?
We are very defiant because we are in a situation of rule by law, not rule of law. All the decisions, directives are in favor of the NRM. And the intimidation and the arrest and the brutality is to another level. So we are resilient when we talk of revolutionary, the struggle. We are determined to defy this. Nothing is going to intimidate any of us. That is what he's talking about.
That was Dr. Zegriga Waru, Deputy President of the Opposition National Unity Platform Party of Uganda. She was speaking with us from the capital, Kampala. You're listening to Daybreak Africa on the Voice of America. I'm James Butte in Washington. Today is Thursday, November 5th. A survey of some 300 members of parliament in 19 countries finds cases of human rights violations, including physical abuse, sexual violence, torture, and arbitrary arrest of opposition MPs that are on the rise. Lisa Schlein reports for VOA from Geneva.
In a new report, the Interparliamentary Union in Geneva expresses concern about alleged human rights violations against parliamentarians in countries involved in recently held and coming elections. It says dozens of opposition MPs have had their rights to freedom of expression, assembly, and movement severely curtailed. The report says the arbitrary arrest, release, and rearrest of opposition MPs has become a favorite tactic of intimidation by state authorities. For example, Ugandan police have arrested and released opposition figure Bobby Wine multiple times, most recently on Tuesday, when police also allegedly threw tear gas in his car. He has denied planning rallies that could disrupt public order. The IPU has reviewed the cases of 9 Ivorian opposition MPs who have been arbitrarily arrested and detained on charges of causing public disorder and spreading fake news. It says there is no evidence proving their guilt and that the charges appear to be politically motivated in the run-up to elections held on October 31st. The IPU has been monitoring the situation in Venezuela for a number of years. IPU spokesman Thomas Fitzsimons tells VOA the level of intimidation and threats to which opposition MPs are subjected makes it unlikely that parliamentary elections on December 6th will be free and fair.
The overwhelming majority of those 134 parliamentarians have been attacked, harassed, or otherwise intimidated. I mean, as I said, it can go from, you know, just social media abuse to actual physical violent abuse. So there are different scales different levels on the scale of intimidation. But yeah, I would say that they are all being threatened in some way or other.
Fitzsimons says a new case of great concern is that of Joanna Mamombe, an opposition MP in Zimbabwe. He says she was detained in May after participating in a public protest to gain more protection for the poor during the coronavirus pandemic.
But the country was in lockdown, so she was arrested on that pretext. And in prison, the reports that we heard is that she was allegedly tortured with, you know, violence of a sexual nature as well. So we're very concerned about that report.
IPU spokesman Fitzsimons says Mamombe has since been released on bail and reportedly rearrested. He says the constant intimidation of detention, release, and rearrest is a strategy employed by many state authorities to weaken the opposition and stay in power. There was no reaction from any of the countries mentioned. Lisa Schlein for VOA News, Geneva.
The leader of South Africa's third biggest political party, which often describes itself as pro-black, is being criticized for using white lawyers to defend himself against criminal charges. The commander-in-chief of the Economic Freedom Fighters, or EFF, Julius Malema, says white legal representatives are better organized than their black colleagues. Darren Taylor has more.
In recent years, Malema has faced a slew of hate speech charges for comments directed at white South Africans. On Twitter, for example, he said, "The only white man you can trust is a dead white man." Malema often says his white compatriots are fortunate that black people haven't slaughtered them because they supported apartheid. He's currently on trial for allegedly assaulting a white police officer. Malema's defense team consists entirely of white men. The EFF leader was defiant outside court last Friday.
There is some story here that is going around that we are represented by white lawyers. It is true. They will represent us today, tomorrow, and anytime we want.
Malema says his use of exclusively white legal minds proves that the EFF isn't anti-white.
We are a non-racial organization, and our stand against white racists is not against white people. Patriotic white South Africans who love their country, who love their constitution, who want to share the wealth and the land with their own people, they are more than welcome.
And this, he says, describes his white lawyers, who he adds are simply more competent than their black colleagues.
When we were losing cases with black lawyers, failing to submit the simplest thing like a one page, and then we must use the same services, lose cases so that we can be projected as the most disorganized organization with no direction. To hell with all of you.
Political commentator Eusebius McKaiser questions why the EFF leader feels it necessary to justify his employment of white legal representatives so vehemently.
If anyone criticizes him, they are simply not thinking clearly about the right that a citizen has to choose legal representation, and whoever they choose, it's up to them.
He says Malema has shone the spotlight on himself by ironically using an anti-black argument to defend his lily-white lawyers.
What did Julius say? He basically says, well, we've had lawyers in the past who have been completely useless with keeping records. Now we are going with lawyers that we can trust as better lawyers in terms of being the attorneys of record. Why are you generalizing? If a particular lawyer is coincidentally black and they turn out to let you down, then why don't you say, Polani let me down, Jabu let me down, and then you are criticizing that incompetent attorney as an individual.
But McKaiser says Malema has used the ineptitude of a couple of black lawyers to call all black South African attorneys incompetent.
That is classically what white supremacists do. They take the mistakes or the incompetence of an individual black person as indicative of the incompetence of the entire group called black attorneys. Ultimately, the leader of the EFF has demonstrated that he is capable of anti-black racism.
McKaiser says Malema's latest diatribe is evidence of the psychological damage that apartheid continues to inflict on South Africans. The commentator says it's very disturbing to see that the EFF chief suffers from the inferiority complex that the racist system created in the minds of some black people. In customary fashion, Malema snaps back that in many respects he feels superior to white people. For VOA News, I'm Darren Taylor in Johannesburg.
Vote counting continues in Tuesday's U.S. general election, but as we have been reporting, there were several candidates of African descent who contested for state and federal level offices. One of them is Nequita Ricks of Liberian descent, who ran for state representative for the state of Colorado District 40. Ms. Ricks joins us this morning to say that she won her position. Good morning, Nequita, and welcome back to Daybreak Africa.
Good morning, James. Thank you for having me. Two times in a row. I'm excited.
Congratulations. How do you feel about winning?
Oh, my God. I'm so thrilled. I'm elated. I had to pinch myself at least a couple times to feel like, is this really real? But yes, I am so thrilled to be the representative elect for House District 40, Colorado.
Nequita, to what do you think you owe your victory?
I owe my victory to the good people of House District 40 who saw in me a candidate that would be a voice for them at the state capitol and one that was ready to work for them day one, to work on an economy that's going to work for everyone, to work on some of the pressing issues around education, small businesses, unemployment, and all of the impact that COVID has wreaked on our community. So I think that they liked our platform and they came out in droves to vote for us. And so I'm so excited.
How long is your tenure? I mean, for how many years are you elected for your position?
As a state representative, my tenure is every 2 years. I have to rerun. I can run for four terms, so a total of 8 years.
I know there were many of you with African descent who ran for offices around the United States. Have you been able to hear from any of the other candidates?
You know, I've just been so consumed with phone calls and stuff, but I am going to be reaching out and I'm wishing them well. There were so many great, awesome, unique candidates that were running, and I'm hoping that they have found success in, you know, their races, people running for Congress, people running for state representatives. Also, a guy was running for Secretary of State. So I'm hoping that they were, you know, also successful in their races.
I know I asked this question when I first talked with you a week or so ago. What does this victory mean in terms of your faith in democracy and the United States as a whole?
You know, I think it really makes me a believer, but I think it also, I was already a believer when I stepped out there by faith, knowing that maybe the odds were against me. But I still believe that America is one of the greatest country in the world, that if you play by the rules, you work hard, you can be successful. And where would a refugee from a war-torn country coming here and having this privilege to run for state representative is such an awesome privilege that I don't take lightly at all. And I think that, you know, people are open to hearing where you're coming from. And that's what makes America great. This is the example that we set in democracy. And I'm so excited for all the voters that turned out to vote, because your vote is your voice. It is so important to cast it, and every vote does matter. I mean, as we sit and watch the national election, we know that every vote is important and that every vote, it looks like, will be counted in this.
Nequita, thank you very much again for joining us, and once again, congratulations.
Thank you, James.
Nequita Ricks is a Liberian-born immigrant candidate who just won as a state representative in the U.S. state of Colorado. She was speaking with us from Aurora, Colorado. And that's it for this Thursday, November 5th edition of Daybreak Africa. On behalf of the Daybreak Africa team, producer Nicole Beckford, reporters Peter Clotty and Reiki Shryak, as well as post editor Samson O'Malley, along with all of our engineers, I'm James Barty in Washington, hoping that you will have a beautiful day.
Next on Encounter, host Carol Castiel talks with two U.S. political experts on the outcome of the 2020 U.S. presidential and congressional elections and what it means for U.S. domestic and foreign policy. That's Encounter this Saturday and Sunday on The Voice of America.